Perhaps you've heard the story. There was a young boy who loved horses, and he'd been sent off to live with his grandparents on a farm following the death of his parents. Now, his grandparents were very strict and came up with lots of chores for him to do. And on Christmas Day, the boy was directed to a shed full of manure and told to clean it out. And he went about the task with a lot of enthusiasm, happily saying to himself, "Well, there must be a pony somewhere." What an example of hope when one is faced with a pile of manure. It seems the young boy agrees with Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote, "But in the mud and scum of things, there always, always something sings." As a matter of fact, some might say that the young boy was a wildly cockeyed optimist. Many of us indeed confuse hope with optimism, an attitude that things turn out for the best. But as we heard in our reading, hope differs from optimism. Hope does not arise from being told to think positively or from hearing an overly rosy forecast. No, hope, unlike optimism, is rooted in unalloyed reality. And certainly, there could not be a much more graphic reality than a shed full of manure. Hope is one of our central emotions, but we often are at a loss when we're asked to define it. Although there's no uniform definition of hope, one contemporary author described it in the following words: "Hope is the elevating feeling that we experience when we see in the mind's eye a path to a better future. Hope acknowledges the significant obstacles and deep pitfalls along the way. True hope has no room for delusion. Clear-eyed hope gives us courage to confront our circumstances and the capacity to surmount them. Hope is the elevating feeling we experience when we see in the mind's eye a path to a better future. We have, in recent years, tragically, experienced the results when some young Palestinians and Saudi Arabians have come to no longer have hope, who have not been able to see in their mind's eye a path to a better future. And when they cannot see a path to a better situation in this world, then they have too often heeded the teachers of a truncated, perverted form of Islam, which offered them the so-called alternative of a path to a better situation in heaven." This is almost exactly the opposite of the proponents of classical Unitarianism in the United States as the century turned from the 1890s to the 1900s. Their hope-filled cry, these Unitarians, was the continuing progress of man, as they put it, in this world, onward and upward forever. In the past, in part, their belief, which sounds rather naive today, was a product of their upper-class privileged position and their belief that all social problems called to be solved and could be solved by applying rational solutions. They had not counted on such figures as Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, who arose in the 20th century. But we Unitarian Universalists still have as the foundation of our approach to life today a specific theology and philosophy about the essence of humanity, which leads to a hope-filled approach to life. For us, humanity is not seen as being encumbered with original sin, but rather, to use the words of theologian Matthew Fox, we look to humanity's origins as being an original blessing. For the Reverend William Ellery Channing, the founder of organized Unitarianism in the United States, and for many whom he influenced, especially Emerson, and others among the Transcendentalists. The principal goal of religion was self-culture, or spiritual development. When Channing articulated this as religion's goal, he issued a doubly radical repudiation of the New England Calvinism in which he had been reared. In saying that the self should be cultivated, Channing was thinking of it as worthy and precious and not naturally depraved, as the Calvinists claim. And Channing, in saying that the soul can be influenced in its growth, he was rejecting the Calvinist teaching that what happened to the soul was predestined and utterly beyond one's control. The metaphor that Channing used was that of a holy potential already embedded in each person, a potential already unfolding. The image is as good a one as can be imagined, that of a divine seed in every person, a seed that religion can cultivate and help the development to take place. But the church doesn't need to stamp out blightedness. The seed is good. The church needn't give it direction or motivation. It's already there. The seed is potent, with an inner urge to unfold and to grow. What an upbeat, empowering, hope-filled, future-oriented image. And lest we slight our Universalist heritage, the Reverend John Murray, the founder of organized Universalism in the United States, was equally upbeat and hope-promoting. He wrote, "Go out into the highways and byways, give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it, let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage." And so our Unitarian forebears were urged to develop their potential and to help it unfold and grow. And from this has flowed all the ideas regarding improvement of our being a work in progress, our jogging, our taking up yoga and continuing education courses and drawing on the other side of our brains. Our Universalist ancestors were urging us to use the light, their light, in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts of others. The story is told that there was once a couple that decided to begin attending a Unitarian Universalist church after taking an informal survey of the various types of churches in the area. For the purpose of their survey, they didn't attend the services at those churches, but rather they stationed themselves in the parking lot of each church. And as the people were coming out of the church, they based their decision to attend the church, the UU church, on the fact that the folks emerging from that congregation, more than any other, were talking together in an animated way, had the most smiles on their faces, and seemed to be the most upbeat, joyful, and hope-filled people. But oftentimes today, it seems as if Unitarian Universalists reflect only the first half of the famous quotation often attributed to Robert Kennedy, but which was actually penned by George Bernard Shaw and quoted by Robert Kennedy. These Unitarian Universalists reflect only, there are those that look at things the way they are and ask why. Some UUs wring their hands and repeating, "Why, oh why?" over the current situation of the environment or civil liberties or education or war or politics, and see things in general as going to hell in a handbasket, that is, if they believed in hell. Too often we forget our UU heritage, which calls us rather to be those who heed the hope-filled second half of George Bernard Shaw's quotation. "I dream of things that never were and ask why not." We forget the Reverend John Murray's admonition, "Give them not hell, but hope and courage." Eleanor Roosevelt once said, that the most important word in the English language is hope. Recent cutting-edge discoveries in the fields of biology and medicine are affirming that the word meaning hope may actually be the most important word in every language. Less than 2 years ago, Harvard Medical School professor Dr. Jerome Groopman, who's a specialist in hematology and oncology, he published his most recent book, The Anatomy of Hope. This joins his other excellent works reflecting on the practice of medicine, The Measure of Our Days, and Second Opinions. I highly recommend all of these to you. In The Anatomy of Hope, Dr. Groopman takes seriously looking at the biology of hope and the role it plays in the practice of medicine. Dr. Groopman's most recent work has this following subtitle, The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. As some of you know, after being a UU Parish minister for 26 years, for 5 years I worked as a hospital chaplain so that my children could remain in the same school system and graduate with their friends. And thus, Dr. Groopman's exploration of hope in a medical setting has great resonance in what my day-to-day existence entailed as a hospital chaplain. Dr. Groopman sets forth the fact that a vast popular literature exists which contends that positive emotions affect the body in health and disease. Dr. Groopman believes that most of this is vague and unsubstantiated and merely wishful thinking. He goes on to say that these books depict hope as a magic word, as a fairy tale, which by itself will miraculously restore a patient. As a rational scientist trained to decode the essence of DNA and to decipher the function of proteins, he writes, I feel and I flee the fairy tale claims of this type of hope. Very conveniently, for the purposes of my offering these remarks this morning, less than 2 years ago also, a major academic study concluded that a person's emotions did not directly affect the progress and outcome of disease, but they could affect how well patients follow diets or exercise regimens, for instance, and these in turn, how well they followed them, had some effect on the progress and the outcome of their disease. Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a 19th century Boston Unitarian physician, poet, essayist, he cautioned, beware how you take hope away from another human being. A physician should never sit like a judge over a desperate patient and hand down a fixed sentence of days or weeks or months of remaining life, even when the patient expects it. Literary figure and longtime editor of the Saturday Review, Norman Cousins, who wrote so eloquently about his own illness, once stated that the human body experiences a powerful gravitational pull in the direction of hope. And that is why the patient's hopes are the physician's secret weapon. They are the hidden ingredients in any prescription. Prominent Holocaust survivor, and I bring up his name on this Sunday in which the world is commemorating the Holocaust. Prominent Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel agrees with the idea that just as despair can come to one only from other human beings, hope too can be given to one only by other human beings. The Reverend Jesse Jackson put it this way, hold your head high, stick your chest out, you can make it. It gets dark sometimes, but morning comes. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. And I was in Chicago several times when I heard Jesse Jackson at his Operation Push Saturday morning meetings getting this chant going in his gathered congregation. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Let's try that. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Saying it like we mean it. I once was reminded extremely forcibly about how important this role of offering hope to others is. There was a man in his middle years who attended the congregation where I was minister for a couple of weeks. He was very active in his labor union, and he'd first come to the church because of a newspaper story about how the church had supported the people of El Salvador in their quest to organize labor unions there. After the second Sunday service he attended, he followed me into my office, and he shut the door, and he advanced toward me to be right up in my face as he demanded, "Where were you? Where were you a couple of months ago when I had to have heart bypass surgery, and the only religion I knew about was the one in which my brother and I were raised? And when I was in the pre-op area, just as I was about to be administered anesthesia, and my brother's pastor came and planted fear in me by reminding me that I might not wake up after the surgery, and was I certain about where I was going to spend eternity? Where were you back then?" he bellowed. "Where were you, and where was this church?" I didn't have any idea that there was a whole congregation of folks who thought the same way as I did about religion. You and this congregation were a well-kept secret from the likes of me. Over time, he became one of the congregation's most active members, bringing several of his buddies and their family to the church as well. Or, if you will, consider the tale of another UU minister, a colleague of mine. For over 30 years, she had told her college roommate of the ups and downs of her career as a UU minister, but not what Unitarian Universalism was all about. They exchanged Christmas letters annually and traveled on some study tours together in the summer. Her college roommate retired to Florida, from where she wrote my colleague a note saying that she begun attending a Unitarian Universalist congregation recently and found that it had made such a significant difference. She only wished that she had known what Unitarian Universalism was all about for the last 30 years. And oh, how she wished that her college roommate had cared enough to tell her. Does it make a difference that you have discovered Unitarian Universalism? Discovered that there were whole congregations of people who shared an open-minded, inclusive approach to religion? Isn't there someone you know who might like to become one of those leaving church with a smile? Don't you want to join with others such as Jesse Jackson, who lead the chant, "Keep hope alive"?